All right, so this is Bio 160. I think I have the microphone turned on. And don't forget, we got a test next time, Thursday, on chapters 12, 13, 14, and 16. And we're going to finish up 16 today. Maybe move on to digestive system. Maybe not. I'm not quite sure. I've also passed out some of the study questions for the respiratory system. Does anybody need these? I think you're all set. I'll put these down on the floor here by the handouts so that if anybody wants. And then don't forget, I always put the handouts by my office. So if you lose yours, you can come by and pick up a handout or the study. Also, you know what? Let me mention something. On this study guide, I put an internet web link for you. It says pulmonary volumes. That's a little animation self-test that you can work through to check to make sure that you understand how to read the spirometry curves. And we'll go over that today. But if you go to that, they'll just automatically load up a little program for you on your computer where you can check to see if you know how to label the ventilator volumes, the spirometry volumes. Okay. So who's got a question? Who's got a question? Question? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, I put whatever is up there that I have. I know I missed a day, and that one was not recorded. Only part of the lymphatic system was recorded, but not all of it. So I don't have a recording to put up there for lymphatic system. Okay? Yeah. So that's, yeah, the way that goes for that one. Okay. So let's get back to the lecture. So the importance of the lungs, just generally speaking, is for exchange. So in your lungs, oxygen enters your blood, and also in your lungs, carbon dioxide leaves. So the exchange is oxygen going in, carbon dioxide going out. So there has to be a way for these molecules to move. There's got to be a doorway for exchange, and that's a surface area. And the functional part of the lung where these gases can move back and forth is that little spherical object, that little tiny little berry. What did we call that little berry? An alveolus. So your lungs are filled with these alveoli, and there are blood vessels that go around them, all right, that pick up that oxygen. So for instance, here's a little capillary right there where the blood is going through. So notice that the capillary is very close to the air that's inside an alveolus. And that's perfect for exchange to take place. So how many of these alveoli do your lungs have? About 300 million. That's pretty much a textbook number. 300 million. So if you got 300 million of these things inside your thoracic cavity, you can imagine how big they are. How big are they? They're really small. Okay. All right. And if we were to take an apple or an orange and peel the apple or the orange and lay that peel down on a table and flatten it out, we could measure the surface area, right? Because what's the surface area of this piece of paper right here? It's 8.5 inches times 11 inches. That would be the surface area of this piece of paper. So if we take the surface of an orange or an apple and lay it flat on a table, just flatten it all out, we could measure the surface area of that skin of an apple. And we can do the same thing with an alveolus, right? If we take all of those 300 million alveoli and lay that out on a table so that it's nice and flat, guess what the surface area would be? It would be 70 square meters. So that's a huge surface area. So when you think of surface area, what should you really be thinking about in your mind? Functionally, what is it? A couple different ways, but a surface area is really what? It's a doorway for exchange. That's the way that things can either enter or leave your body. So surface area is a doorway. Just like we could measure the surface area of that door right down over there. What's the surface area of this door? Right here. Here's a meter stick. It's a meter long. So how would we measure the surface area of this door right here? Have to measure the width? Yeah? So what's the width? Well, oh, really nice. It's exactly 1 meter. That's handy. And what's the height? It's one. It's what? It's exactly 2 meters. So the surface area of this door would be 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. All right, so that's a nice doorway. But what can you tell me about the doorway in your lungs for exchange? It's not 2 square meters, it's 70 square meters. It's huge.
How is that possible?
Because those alveoli are so small that you just can pack such a big surface area in there. And the alveolus, the wall of this alveolus is what? Microscopically thin. Mm-hmm. It's much thinner than a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. Right? It's probably 10 times or 100 times thinner than a piece of paper. So if you fold up a bunch of pieces of paper that are so thin, you could just put millions of pieces of paper in there.
So they're all like folded together? And
yeah, but they inflate. They blow up and your chest expands. All right, and then they shrink back down. We'll look at that. So I want to give you a feel for what 70 square meters is. That's a half of a tennis court. So that's really interesting that the doorway, through evolution, has been compressed to fit inside your thoracic cavity because it's all been folded up. Okay. So folding is a way to make a big surface area fit a much smaller volume. And personally, I think that's a big advantage because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall just to breathe. Okay. So that's really nice. So the site of gas exchange in the lung has to occur through something that we call the respiratory membrane. So let's look at the respiratory membrane. All right, so here is a bunch of alveoli, but don't forget, you've got 300 million of these alveoli in your lungs. All right, so we're going to look at the distance that oxygen has to diffuse across to get from an alveolus into your blood. So let's look at this diagram right here. So here is an alveolus, forms a little berry, right? And you got 300 million of these in your lungs. Here is blood coming in surrounding the alveolus, and you can see that the blood is colored blue right over here as it's entering because it's deoxygenated. And then as it flows around the alveolus, what happens? CO2 leaves, oxygen goes into the blood, and it changes color in this diagram from kind of a bluish color to red. Red meaning that it's oxygenated. So what does carbon dioxide, what are the layers that carbon dioxide has to move across, or oxygen have to move across to get from the air into the blood? That's what we call the respiratory membrane. Okay. So there are four things. There's a little chemical that's lining the surface of the alveolus right here. And we call that surfactant. So that's the first layer, just a small molecular layer of surfactant. And then it's got to go through the wall that makes up the alveolus. Now, what kind of cells do these look like right here? Can you think back way back to the days when you were looking at tissues, for instance? How many cell layers thick do we see right here? One. So what do we call that? That's simple. And then what about the shape of these cells? I like your answer. Are they cuboidal? Are they columnar? Or are they flat? They're flat. So what do we call flat cells? Squamous. So this is just a simple squamous epithelium that makes the alveolus up. Right, so that's the second layer. So you got surfactant, wall of the alveolus, which is just a simple squamous epithelium. You've got a little interstitial space filled with some fluid right here. And then you've got the wall of the capillary, and the wall of the capillary itself is a simple squamous epithelium. All right, so these are the four things that make up the respiratory membrane. Surfactant, wall of the alveolus, interstitial space and then wall of the capillary, and it's a very, very thin membrane, so that allows for a lot of diffusion. Okay. Well, we probably want to learn something about surfactant. What's the role of surfactant? Why do we have a chemical lining the alveolus in all these alveoli? What can you tell me about water? What, somebody tell me something about water that you know.
It evaporates.
It evaporates. I like that. It flows downhill, right? But is water slippery, for instance, or is water sticky? Water is actually very sticky. It does like to stick together. And we'll do just a quick little experiment on that issue right now. For instance, let's take these two transparencies that I have right here. And right now, they're dry. Are they dry? Wet? They're not wet. Okay. So if I stick them together, right, like this, or if I put them together, and then if I just hold one and hold them up, what's going to happen to the one that I'm not holding? It's just going to slip down, right? Just like that. So there's nothing between them except air. Air isn't sticky at all. But now what's going to happen when I put some water between them? I don't think I've done this in here yet. Does this work? Yeah. Okay, just a little bit of water. Not even very much water. So if I put a little water between them, okay, like that. So now I'm holding both of them and then I let go of one. What happens? They get stuck together. Okay? And as a matter of fact, if you pull on it, can you tell me, is there a lot of force on there? Mm-hmm. They're really stuck together quite a bit, right? You really need a lot of force to pull these two pieces of plastic apart. Okay, so, and do you have a lot of water inside your body? Absolutely. You're almost all water, right? And so there's water inside of this alveolus right here. So when you exhale, the alveolus will collapse a little bit and one wall will touch the other wall. And if it's just plain water, what's going to happen? They're going to get stuck together. So when you try to inhale, they won't be able to inflate. And then, of course, you'll suffocate. So that surfactant keeps the alveoli, the walls of the alveolus from sticking together. So you need surfactant in order to inflate all those 300 million alveoli in your lungs.
Is that what happens when people drown? Or is it just the lungs filling with water?
Lungs fill up with water. That's bad. But you know what? That's probably a contributing factor. Because there's so much water, it dilutes out the surfactant and you have trouble inflating your lungs as a result of that. Yeah. Yeah, definitely true. But it also causes problems for other people. What's another group of people where that could cause a problem for? For instance, that's right, premature infants. Babies that are born prematurely, there are certain cells within the alveolus that secrete that surfactant, and if you're born by cesarean section, for instance, or prematurely by other natural means, those cells don't produce surfactant, and when you're born, you can't inhale because these alveoli are still stuck together. So certain premature babies have a problem with that. And then what do? To help them? We put them in an oxygen tank, right? We can't just slap them on the butt because that still won't help them. All right, they'll try to inhale, but they still won't be able to inflate those alveoli. So we put them in an oxygen tent, so there's a higher concentration gradient for oxygen, so oxygen still gets into their blood, even though their lungs aren't functioning. Yeah, I think there is a shot. I'm not sure I know what it is called. But the best thing is, what really turns the cells on that secrete surfactant is stress. When the infant experiences stress. And so what's a very normal, stressful situation for a newborn? Just the process of being born is very stressful, and that's usually the signal that turns on these cells that secrete surfactant. So pretty much I think any newborn that's born by cesarean section, they don't experience that stress. You always have to be concerned about whether that individual is going to produce enough surfactant to breathe normally without assistance early on. But it's especially true if it's a premature baby. Okay, so that's the importance of that surfactant right there. Okay, who's got a question on that? Like, I don't know how I'm going to ever get those slides back apart again. Okay, so how do our bodies transport oxygen and carbon dioxide? Okay, the two different things. We need two different kinds of systems in our body for transmitting these or transporting these chemicals. And don't forget, you need oxygen in order to make ATP from glucose and mitochondria. Remember, mitochondria make ATP. And 97% of the oxygen that your body transports in the blood is combined with a chemical which we call heme. But it's reversible, so that means that oxygen can bind to it and then disassociate from heme. Only 3% of the oxygen that our body needs is dissolved in plasma. So oxygen doesn't necessarily like to dissolve into water at all. It doesn't have a very high affinity. It has to combine with hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is the chemical compound that fills up our red blood cells. And hemoglobin is, it kind of has a red color when it's bound to oxygen, so arterial blood usually is diagrammed or illustrated as a red color, because that means that it's carrying oxygen. Carbon dioxide, on the other hand, is not necessarily transported by red blood cells or by hemoglobin. 8% can dissolve in water. So carbon dioxide can dissolve in water a lot more easily than oxygen can. So you don't hardly even need red blood cells. Well, you don't need red blood cells to carry that much carbon dioxide. 20% is carried by blood proteins. So just the proteins that are in your plasma can carry carbon dioxide from your tissues to your lungs, where you can exhale it. But most of it, which is 72%, is transported as a totally different compound that we call bicarbonate. So most of the carbon dioxide, or 72%, is transported in your blood as this different chemical compound that we call bicarbonate. Now, how does carbon dioxide get converted into bicarbonate? There is a chemical reaction right here. If we take carbon dioxide, which is what? CO2. And we take H2O. What's H2O? Water. All right. It can form bicarbonate. So here is bicarbonate, HCO3. And HCO3 is very soluble in plasma. It just likes to dissolve in plasma. Give me another chemical that you know of that will dissolve in water very easily. Say that again? Oh yeah, like sodium chloride, like table salt. You put table salt. You could put a lot of table salt into water and it will dissolve. Same thing for bicarbonate. You can put as much bicarbonate in water and it will dissolve as you can table salt. Or glucose, sugar, table sugar. You can put a lot of sugar in water and it will dissolve. Same thing for bicarbonate. It just likes to dissolve in water. And where does this bicarbonate ion come from? It comes from CO2, this gas that your body produces. But you do need an enzyme to interconvert these different forms of this chemical right here. And the name of that enzyme is called carbonic anhydrase. So that's probably important for you to know. Carbonic anhydrase catalyzes that reaction, which interconverts carbon dioxide and bicarbonate. So in order for your body to transport carbon dioxide, it's got to have carbonic anhydrase. So here is a really easy question. What enzyme interconverts CO2 and bicarbonate? You would say?
Carbonic
anhydrase. Yeah, just say carbonic anhydrase. Right. Okay, so and that's how CO2 is transported in your body, and in particular in your blood. All right, so how does your body control your rate of respiration, your rate of breathing? It happens in a place that we call the respiratory center. And the respiratory center is in your brain, central nervous system. And there are two parts, the medulla oblongata and the pons contain the respiratory centers that control your rate and depth of respiration. So the medulla and the pons send signals out to the diaphragm. That's a muscle for inspiration. And the diaphragm separates your thoracic cavity from your abdominal cavity. And when it contracts, It pulls down, and when it pulls down, your lungs inflate, or air runs into your lungs, and you absorb that oxygen. So there's got to be a nerve that carries the signals from the medulla down to the diaphragm, and here's the name of that nerve. You might have heard of this nerve because we do talk about it all the time, and like in the news and things like that. It's called the phrenic nerve. So the phrenic nerve goes to the diaphragm. What do you think happens to this diaphragm right here if that phrenic nerve gets damaged? You can't breathe. That's right, because the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle. That means that it's under your voluntary control. You can hold your breath. You can stop that diaphragm from contracting just by your consciousness, right? Or you can hyperventilate if you want, or take a deep breath or a shallow breath or whatever. So the diaphragm is under voluntary control via the phrenic nerve from this part of the brain right here. And the phrenic nerve comes from three different places. Where it leaves the spinal cord, it leaves from the levels of C3, C4, and C5. What does that C stand for? This is kind of interesting because your diaphragm is way down here, but C stands for cervical region. That means that that nerve leaves your central nervous system way up in your neck, and then it travels all the way to your diaphragm. Okay? And that's probably a pretty good thing because it's not uncommon for somebody to damage their spinal cord. And if your spinal cord is damaged, the nerve impulses can't get past that place where it's damaged. And you think it's a good idea to breathe all the time? Yeah, you have to breathe, otherwise you're dead, right? So if the signals had to go all the way through the spinal cord down to the diaphragm, any spinal cord injury above that level would be fatal, right? So the only thing we really have to worry about is to preserve the function of the diaphragm is cervical injuries or neck injuries. And that's at the level or above the level of C3, C4, and C5. So can you remember how many cervical vertebrae you had? There's seven, right, for breakfast, like 7 a.m. Okay, so C1, C2, C3, C4, C5, all the way down to number 7. And these junctions right here between these cervical vertebrae develop or have origins that make the phrenic nerve. All right, so there's a little saying that says where that phrenic nerve comes from. And that little saying is C3, C4, and C5 keeps you alive because you want to maintain the integrity of that part of somebody's cervical region in order for them to be able to breathe by themselves. Okay, so just say C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive, and then you know the origin of that phrenic nerve. So if you have, for instance, injury at C4, can you still breathe? Well, the phrenic nerve won't get signals from C4 or C5, but there still can be signals that leave your central nervous system from C3, and you'll still be able to breathe. So that's a really good thing. And so these signals have to go through that cervical nerve plexus, and so nerve signals can take alternate routes to get to the diaphragm, so that's the beauty of that nerve plexus in your cervical region. Okay, what about inputs to the respiratory center? There are chemoreceptors. And you've got two different kinds of chemoreceptors, but first, what does a chemoreceptor measure? What is it sensitive to? It's sensitive to chemicals, some kind of chemical, right? That's what a chemoreceptor is sensitive to. And in particular, these central receptors. All right, so central means like central nervous system. A peripheral receptor is going to be outside of the central nervous system, maybe your peripheral nervous system someplace. The central receptors are very sensitive. These are in your brain. They're sensitive to small changes in certain kinds of chemicals that are in your body. And these receptors, these chemoreceptors, are located in the medulla and the pons, which is handy because that's where the respiratory center is located. And these receptors are very sensitive to carbon dioxide levels that are in your body, as well as pH. What's a pH a measure of? Acidity, right? And as the pH goes down, what happens to acidity in your body? Don't forget, it's tricky. As the pH number goes down, what happens to acidity? It goes up, right? All right, so these chemoreceptors, whenever your body becomes more acidic, or the pH goes down, or if the CO2 level goes up, that's going to stimulate these receptors, and these receptors are going to tell the respiratory center to increase ventilation. You will start hyperventilating. You'll start breathing faster. Okay, and I think that should make sense because, for instance, if you hold your breath, what happens to the levels of CO2 in your body? Since you're not breathing, what's happening to CO2 in your body? Your body is accumulating CO2 because your body is producing CO2 all the time. What's maybe not so intuitive is when you hold your breath, the pH of your body becomes more acidic as well. Okay, so that's sort of interesting because when we exhale, we actually exhale a lot of acid from our body, just in the air that we breathe. That's kind of an interesting concept. Okay. All right, so that's the first place, the central receptors in the medulla and the pons. And then we have some peripheral receptors. And these are only sensitive to large changes in chemical compounds. So they usually don't operate very much in our normal everyday life. And they're located in the carotid sinus and the aortic arch. Can you remember where the arch of the aorta is? Remember where the heart is, and then there's the aorta and then that big arch. But there are chemoreceptors in there. And these chemoreceptors are sensitive to oxygen. Right? So this is a place where I was always kind of amazed when I was first studying physiology because I would have thought that maybe it would be very important for your body to measure oxygen. And maybe not pH and CO2, I would have thought that the most important molecule to measure is oxygen because that's really what keeps you alive. But notice that that's really not true. Your body does measure oxygen, but it only gets concerned when there's a drastic decrease in oxygen concentration. See, I put 3 down arrows right here. That means there has to be a big decrease in oxygen before the respiratory center is stimulated into increasing ventilation. And that's because these peripheral receptors are not very sensitive to changes in oxygen concentration. So, let me see. Maybe I have a picture of where some of these things are. Okay, so for instance, here is a picture of somebody's brain, and you can see the cerebrum here and the cerebellum, corpus callosum. Here's a diencephalon with a thalamus in there. Down over here is a spinal cord, and the area that we're interested in today is between the spinal cord and the higher centers of the brain, namely the brain stem, which is made up of the medulla oblongata, which is right here, and the pons. So if we zoom into this area that's a little bit darker in color, okay, this is that area that we're looking at. So here's spinal cord down over here. This is the medulla, and this is the pons. And this is where the respiratory center is. This is where the central chemoreceptors are. And these are the centers that decide on when you should breathe or what your rate and depth of ventilation should be. Okay. Over here, we can see the heart, the aorta, the arch. This is the area that contains other chemoreceptors, primarily for oxygen. And then it will send signals to the brain via some of these nerves that you see. I won't ever ask you about these nerves. And then I can also see the common carotid arteries that are taking blood to your brain. And at this junction right here, this is what we call the carotid sinus. And there are chemoreceptors in the carotid sinus as well, measuring oxygen, okay, and pH and carbon dioxide. And that's a good thing because this is blood that's going to your brain. And of course, you need blood going to your brain all the time. And the proper kind of blood that is oxygenated. Okay. So not only can these central receptors in the medulla influence the rate and depth of your respiration, and not only these receptors in the arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus influence respiration, but also, for instance, higher centers in your cerebral cortex can influence respiration. Like you all right now, you could freak me out totally. You want to learn how you can totally freak me out? If everybody in here were to hold your breath for about 60 seconds, you could do that. You could hold your breath for 60 seconds if you put your mind to it. Because why? Because your cerebral cortex can override the respiratory center. And then what would happen? What would happen to everybody in here? You'd pass out. Okay, and I go, oh my God, I just killed my whole class. What was it that I said? All right? So these higher centers can influence your respiratory rate. All right? But then after you pass out, what's going to happen? I say I wouldn't really get worried because I know that the respiratory center then will take over, and even though you're passed out, you're going to start breathing again. Okay? So I don't know. Some of you have some smiles on your faces. Like you don't believe me, or maybe you've done it yourself already, right? Some kids like to do that to freak their mom and dad out. I don't know if you have a child at home that will do that, or if you've done that, I know. Okay, I'm just kidding, okay? But it's not such a big deal because after you pass out, right, then your brainstem, the medulla and pons are gonna take over and you're gonna breathe normally. So the higher centers are in the cerebral cortex for voluntary control, but also the hypothalamus. Where's that hypothalamus at? Here's the thalamus, here's the hypothalamus, that's just superior to the pituitary gland. That will influence your respiratory rate due to emotional status or emotional content in your life. Right? So when you get very emotional or excited or whatever, what happens to your respiratory rate? Right? It increases. Or if somebody puts a ice cube on your back or something, what's going to happen? You're going to hyperventilate. As a matter of fact, you might even gasp, right? You might go like that. Or if somebody pokes you with a tack or something, right? Those things will change your ventilation rate. You can tell I've had some very lively classes in the past. Okay. So here's the last slide on the respiratory system. Control of respiration continued. There are things called proprioceptors. These things measure tension that's in a tendon. It can measure the stretch of muscles, all the muscles all over your body. These are general sense. These belong to general sensation because you have these receptors in all your muscles, all your joints, all your tendons. All right? And so when these things measure motion in your body, it sort of signals that your body is exercising. And when your body is exercising, you need more or less oxygen. You need more to make more ATP because you're using it up, so that should increase your ventilation rate. So you can artificially trick these proprioceptors to sending signals to your body saying that you're starting to exercise when you're really not exercising. And you should feel an urgency to breathe even when you're not exercising. So for instance, right now, you're not exercising, you're just sitting in a chair. But if all of a sudden you were to move your arms and your legs like this, even though you're really not exercising, guess what you're going to experience? A sensation that you need to breathe. So you could just do that during the test or something. Move around a little bit, and you'll notice that your respiratory rate will increase. And that's just from these proprioceptors that are located everywhere in your body. All right, so what other kind of receptors can stimulate the respiratory centers? Well, touch. Right, somebody pokes you in the side, pain, right, like a needle or a tack or something. Temperature, that ice cube somebody puts on the back of your neck, that will all influence your rate of respiration. But there's also something else that's called the gasp reflex. And that's when you experience something very cold automatically. And this is a very hard reflex to inhibit, so probably should have done this. I should have brought an ice cube in and put it on somebody. What's going to happen? They're going to go... You're going to go like that. That's called a gasp reflex. All right. Well, you see I have a little arrow over here to drowning. Because, for instance, what temperature is the ocean around here? Has anybody ever gone swimming in the ocean around here? Is it warm? Is it tropical? It's freezing cold. Right. It's really actually pretty cold to get in. And Sometimes, for instance, if somebody's out boating around here in the ocean and they fall into the ocean, okay, it's really cold, guess what they're going to do? It's just a reflex. All that cold water hits you, you're going to go like that. All right. Now, that's usually not such a bad thing if you're standing in front of class giving a lecture, but what happens if you're on a boat and you fall into the ocean and your head's underwater when you go like that? Well, now you have your lungs filled up with ocean water, which is bad because air is not getting in there, and that really causes drowning in a lot of people, that gasp reflex. Okay? So, if you're ever out boating someplace and you accidentally fall over, you got to do what? You got to make sure you hold your breath because you're going to have this reflex that will have a tendency to take over to make you gasp for air, and that's really bad. And I remember of a circumstance a couple years ago in Marina Del Rey. There were some people on a dinner cruise celebrating, I think it was an office party, celebrating a Christmas party or something. And there's boats, you know, that can take you around in different harbors. I think Newport Harbor has got some of these boats. It's called Hornblower Yachts. Have you ever heard of Hornblower? But they take you on little harbor cruises. And so one evening in December, a bunch of people, you know, like maybe 50 to 100 people were on one of these boats just going through the harbor. And the boat caught on fire and was in the middle of the harbor. So it's not out on the ocean, it was in the harbor, but still. And it couldn't get to shore, couldn't get to a dock to let people off. And it didn't have lifeboats. All right, so guess what the people had to do? They were dressed up in like tuxes and evening gowns and stuff like this. They had to jump in the water. And I would just go, oh, wow, that would be like the last thing in the world I would want to do, middle of the night, jump into the water, you know, even with swimming suit on, it would be terrible. But I was reading the accounts and nobody drowned, and I was just amazed that nobody drowned, because when you hit that cold water, what happens? You're going to go like that. And then I realized probably what happened was before they threw somebody off the boat, they did what? They maybe held their breath, or they probably put a life jacket on them. Okay, so that when they hit the water, they didn't go really kaplunk and then go down. They probably just kind of broke the surface. But, man, would that be rude to be on a dinner, go out on a dinner party someplace and then have to jump into the ocean because the boat was on fire? Okay. So, that would really be bad. Yeah, it would be very, that would be really memorable. It would not be fun at the moment, but a couple years later, that would be interesting to think about. Okay. All right, so, for instance, did we go over this table right here? I think we did, right? So the instrument that's used to measure these pulmonary volumes is called a spirometer. So the discipline that studies pulmonary volumes or lung volumes is called spirometry. Oh yeah, it's coming back to me now. We did talk about this, right? So you got tidal volume right here and inspiratory reserve, expiratory reserve volume. We put tidal volume together with inspiratory reserve and expiratory reserve, we get a capacity called vital capacity. And then there's always some volume of air that you can't get out of your lungs. What do we call that? That volume that we can never get out. That's that residual volume right there. One last thing. So before you forget about this chart right here, don't forget on the study guide that I gave you a link to where you can practice labeling this diagram right here. So I'm sure everybody should be able to get 100% on this part of the test on Thursday. Okay. Questions?
What was residual volume?
Residual volume, okay, is this part of the pulmonary volume, and residual volume is the volume of air that you can never get out of your lungs, no matter how hard you try to exhale, okay? Even after a maximal expiration, there's still some volume inside your airways that you can't exhale. And so it's like dead air space. How could you measure that, for instance?
Because in the book it says that the dead space is in the bronchioles.
Okay, the tracheal bronchioles. Mm-hmm.
But it says that, it doesn't mention that here. It just says that. Is that the same thing then?
Residual volume would be. Any air that you can't breathe out of your body is residual volume.
Okay.
And there's a way that you measure that. For instance, if you have, just think of a bottle with a little bit of fluid in the bottom of it that's clear, okay? And then you have some ink, like a drop of ink, and you know what the volume of that drop of ink is, right? And then you put that drop of ink inside the bottle that has a little clear fluid in it. What's going to happen to the color of that ink? Is it going to be still the same darkness, or is it going to be diluted out? It's going to be diluted out. So if you take a little bit of volume out, like the little drop out of the bottle, and look at the color and see how much it's been diluted out, you can then calculate how much volume is inside that bottle. And so that's how we would do that with residual volume. And it used to be done with radioisotopes. You just breathe in a little bit amount of radioactivity, and you breathe out the same amount, but then by the amount that the radioactivity decreased, you could figure out how much is still left in your body, and that would be the residual volume. Okay. Well, but you get x-rays, right, all the time. So you don't do it every day. You have to do it for a good reason, right? You'd have to be concerned that somebody is gaining residual volume and losing vital capacity. Like, for instance, if somebody had asthma or emphysema, you might really would like to know what some of these volumes are, because you might want to adjust treatment or something for them. Okay, but a normal, healthy individual, no, you wouldn't do it. But if you're normal and healthy, like right now, you wouldn't go get an x-ray either, right? Yeah, so it's only if the condition is warranted would you do something like that. Okay, well, let's work on some of these questions. What do you say? Okay. So what structures make up the upper respiratory tract? Upper respiratory tract. Here is a good diagram of upper right here. That's an exam figure too, I'm sure. So the upper respiratory tract is nose, nasal cavity, the pharynx, okay. Maybe even your oral cavity, because you can breathe through your mouth if you have to, if your nose gets plugged up. So that's the upper respiratory tract. And where does the lower respiratory tract begin? Right here at the larynx. Right here at the larynx. Right below the epiglottis. So the larynx is part of the lower respiratory tract. The trachea is. The bronchi are. Right, the bronchioles are, all the alveoli, those are your lower respiratory tract. Okay, so which structures of the upper / lower respiratory tract contain cartilage? What about your nose? Yes. What about your larynx? Definitely. A lot of cartilage. Epiglottis has got a lot of cartilage in it, that trapdoor right there. And your thyroid cartilage, which is your Adam's apple, is cartilage. And furthermore, what else? Let's look at some of the lower respiratory tract. Bless you. The trachea has a lot of cartilage. C-shaped rings that are holding the trachea open. And the bronchi, all the bronchi, the primary, secondary, tertiary bronchi, have cartilage as well, holding it open. But when you get down to the level of a bronchiole, terminal bronchiole, alveolar duct, and alveoli, they don't have cartilage. So when you get down to bronchiole, everything distal to a bronchiole does not have cartilage. It has either smooth muscle or just connective tissue, or that epithelium, simple squamous epithelium. Nothing's holding it open. Okay, where does gas exchange take place in the lung? The alveoli. Yeah, alveoli. That's plural. What's singular for alveoli? Alveolus. Yeah. Alveolus. Alveolus. That works too. Okay. All right, what structure usually prevents the entry of food into the larynx? Epiglottis. When does the epiglottis get a little flaky? What day of the week? Friday. And what time on Friday? Happy hour, that's right. So don't think of it as you're like eating some popcorn or shrimp or something, but it does. All right, so the epiglottis. What compound neutralizes surface tension and allows alveoli to expand during inhalation? That's surfactant. Yep, surfactant does. Yeah, surfactant breaks surface tension. Remember that stuff? Surface tension is just a property of water that holds these two pieces of paper together. We put water, and if we were to put surfactant between these two membranes right here, they would just fall apart. It would be slippery. So you know what? Is soap slippery or sticky? It's kind of slippery. So surfactant is actually like a soap. It's a detergent that breaks surface tension down. So that's sort of the way detergents work too. What are two parts of the respiratory membrane? Well, we actually learned four parts. All right, the four parts are a layer of surfactant, the wall of the alveolus, a little interstitial space, and then the wall of the capillary. And I think I put two down over here because, you know what, I think your book only mentions two of those things. Your book just mentions wall of the alveolus and wall of the capillary. So it's a little deficient. What kind of epithelium is an alveolus made of? Simple squamous epithelium. What's the purpose of the shape of the alveoli? Yeah, it allows for them to expand, okay? But this is actually what I think. The shape means that the surface of an alveolus is folded up so that you have this huge surface area inside your thoracic cavity. So it maximizes surface area for exchange. Maximizes surface area for exchange. And then number 9, know where the parietal and viscera pleura is located and what's between these two membranes. Well, the membrane around the lungs is a serous membrane. It's not open to the outside world. And a serous membrane has always got two parts to it. There's one part that covers the surface of the lungs. Here's the slide I'm looking for. Yeah, what do we call the one that's right on the surface of the lungs? The visceral pleura, and you can see that line right there. There's that visceral pleura, right? Because it's right on the surface of the lung. And the other one is on the chest wall. That's what we call the parietal pleura. Pleura is the membrane around the lungs, but it's on two different locations. And then there's a space, right? The pleural space between the visceral pleura and the parietal pleura. And there's just what we call serous fluid in between them. Or pleural fluid, you could call it pleural fluid if you want, but serous fluid. What does it say on the diagram? Does it say anything? It just says cavity, the pleural cavity filled with serous fluid. Okay. What's the name of the instrument that's used to measure pulmonary volumes? Spirometer. Okay, make sure you know what tidal volume, inspiratory reserve, expiratory reserve volumes are, and you can find them on that pulmonary volume graph, and know what vital and residual capacities are. You know what? I like residual volume better. Say residual volume. Maybe your book uses residual capacity, but let's take a look. Okay, so here is the residual volume, and then vital, and a capacity really is a combination of two or more volumes. So vital capacity is anything that you can consciously breathe in and out of your lungs, including inspiratory reserve. Right, inspiratory reserve up over here, expiratory reserve, and tidal volume. Those three volumes make up vital capacity. Number 12, how's oxygen transported in the blood? This is easy. It's attached to something. What is it attached to? Hemoglobin. That's right, hemoglobin. And what is the chemical symbol for bicarbonate? What's the chemical symbol? Bicarbonate is HCO3. HCO3. And what could you tell me? What is bicarbonate used for? What is it? It's for transporting something around in your body. What's it transporting? Carbon dioxide, yeah. So carbon dioxide doesn't bind to hemoglobin like oxygen does. It just gets converted into bicarbonate and it dissolves in the water part of your blood. And what's the name of that enzyme that interconverts carbon dioxide and bicarbonate? Carbonic anhydrase. That's it. Carbonic anhydrase. That's it. Where is the respiratory center located? It's in the brain. Brain stem. Two parts of the brain stem, probably we should know. It's the medulla oblongata and the pons. Those two parts of the brain stem. What nerve innervates the diaphragm? Phrenic nerve. Got to have a phrenic nerve. Where do the spinal roots of the phrenic nerve originate? From what levels? Is it way down by your diaphragm or is it up by in your neck? Yeah, it's up in your neck. It's C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Is what you have to remember. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. All right, where are the chemoreceptors for CO2 and pH located? CO2 and pH, we know that they are central receptors, not peripheral. They're in the medulla oblongata. So pH and CO2 are in the medulla oblongata. And where are the chemoreceptors for oxygen located? Yep, the carotid sinus, which is in your neck, and arch of the aorta, which is in your mediastinum. So two different locations. And now this is a really important question, and I think it's tricky. It's not meant to be tricky, but if you study, it's not tricky, but if you don't, it's really tricky. What chemicals are the most powerful stimuli for ventilation? You might think it's oxygen. And as oxygen decreases, that's going to stimulate your ventilation rate, but that's not true. What chemicals are the most powerful stimuli for ventilation? Surfactant? We don't have any sensors that measure surfactant directly. That's just in newborns. Yeah. What chemicals in your blood stimulate ventilation? Carbon dioxide is one. And also pH, hydrogen ion concentration. As CO2 concentration goes up and hydrogen ion concentration goes up, that means what? pH goes down, that will stimulate ventilation. You will start to breathe. Okay? And what other factors can influence the rate and depth of ventilation? Like what? Emotional states, pain, temperature, okay, even conscious control. You could hyperventilate right now. And probably if you were to hyperventilate long enough and hard enough, you could probably pass out too, as well as hold your breath. If you hyperventilate too much or if you hold your breath, you'll probably end up passing out. Okay. Okay, so that's it for respiratory system. What about some more questions?
So 13.
How is carbon dioxide transported in the blood? As bicarbonate ion? Bicarbonate, and guess what this is right here? HCO3, and we said that, yes, and it's an ion, it's an anion, so that's HCO3 or bicarbonate is exactly the same thing. Bicarbonate ion or HCO3, same thing. Okay.
13 and 14 are the same thing.
Yeah. 13 and 14 the same thing? Oh, yeah, as a matter of fact. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 Four parts. I like the four parts. What are those four parts? What's lining the inside of an alveolus? What's the chemical layer? Surfactant that prevents the alveolus from contracting. All right, so you got surfactant number one. What's the next layer? Wall of the alveolus. What's the next layer? The interstitial space. And then the last one is the wall of the capillary. And I have to sneeze, sorry. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so that's it for respiratory system. Except I got a couple other little things I want to talk to you about. When we inhale, we use a lot of muscles to inhale. I don't have any questions on this for the test, but this is actually pretty important sometimes. What muscle do we use mostly to inhale? You all know that. Diaphragm, for instance. Yeah, that muscle between the thoracic cavity and the abdominal cavity is normally dome-shaped. It kind of pokes up into your lungs. And when it contracts, it moves down like that. So it pulls your lungs down and your lungs inflate. And one property of muscle is that it's elastic. What does elastic mean? When you stretch it out, it does what? Goes back to its original location. So when the diaphragm stops contracting, guess what it does automatically? It goes back up to being this dome-shaped structure. Right? So you inhale, exhale. So most of the processes involved with getting air out of our lungs are due to elasticity of muscles. So we don't really use muscles to exhale. We use muscles to inhale, and then how do we exhale? We relax the muscles and air flows out of our lungs, which is kind of a strange concept. Okay? And so not only are muscles elastic, but there are, so here is an alveolus. You can see it's surrounded by capillaries. And we look at one alveolus here. It's also surrounded by elastic proteins, so that when we inhale, the alveolus expands. And then when we relax, what happens to the alveolus? It goes back because of all those elastic proteins that are around the alveolus, cause the alveolus to shrink back down. So inhalation is active, meaning you need to contract muscles to inhale. But in normal everyday breathing, like what you're doing right now, what we call quiet breathing, you just relax and air normally flows out of your lungs because of all the elastic properties of your muscles and the lungs itself. Okay. It's only when you're exercising, when you start to hyperventilate, do you use muscles to help exhale. Like you compress your abdominal muscles and some other muscles to force air out of your lungs. But now some people have problem with these elastic proteins. They're not made. And guess what they have trouble doing? They have trouble not inhaling, but exhaling. That's right. So, for instance, here it is. I've got another little example. Let's just say that I have two different kinds of alveoli right here. One is this paper bag and one is this balloon. And you got to tell me which one is a better model for an alveolus in your lungs. Okay? Paper bag or a rubber band? Well, let me put balloon. Okay, so here is a paper bag left over from my local liquor store. And we're going to pretend that this is an alveolus that's going to inflate. So let's inflate this alveolus. Okay, so I've trapped the air in here, right? And if I let go, what's going to happen to the air inside the paper bag? Is it going to rush out? No. Okay, I leave it right there. All right, so this person, if they have an alveolus like that, what can't they do? They can't exhale, which means they can't inhale anymore to get more air inside their lungs. So that just means that the alveoli have to be nice and elastic. All right, now here is another kind of alveolus, signified by this nice balloon. So let's inflate this alveolus. Need some surfactant. I'm wondering if something's wrong with me. I don't know. I think the balloon's okay. that's enough. I don't want it to blow up. Okay, now what would happen to the air inside the balloon if I let the balloon go? Is it going to stay there like the paper bag?
No.
It's going to escape because why? The wall of the balloon is what? It's elastic, right? So for exhalation, that's just a passive process. All right, so which one is a better model for how an alveolus works? The paper bag or the balloon? The balloon, that's right, because, right, I'll just give you a little demonstration. Because you could go like that. What happens? The air is running out of the balloon because of the elastic properties of the balloon. So that's how you exhale. Thank goodness we don't exhale like that, otherwise we'd all be flying around the room all the time. All right, it's a little bit more controlled. All right, so but that's a nice demonstration to show you how important those elastic proteins are. All right, so I think that's it for today. So next time you need a Scantron 882E, a good eraser, non-spindled and mutilated Scantron pencil. Okay, so that's it. Yeah. No, you're not. I didn't grade them. I had so many students come by my office with questions, I didn't have time to grade them. But, you know, if you're dying to get it back, come on up to my office, I'll grade it, I'll give it back to you today. Okay? Or if you got questions, I would answer some questions.
Okay.